You can hear and understand me perfectly. Nod a little if you hear me. The calm face did not change, but the head nodded once, like the head of a puppet on a string. Good. Now listen carefully. You're going to have another vivid dream. You'll dream that there's a mural photograph on the wall here in my office. A big picture of Mount Hood, all covered with snow. You'll dream that you see the mural there on the wall behind the desk, right here in my office. All right, now you're going to sleep and dream. Antwerp. He bustled and bowed at his machinery again. There, he whispered under his breath. There, okay, right. The machines were still. George lay still. Even Haber ceased to move and mutter. There was no sound in the big, softly lit room, with its wall of glass looking out into the rain. Haber stood by the EEG, his head turned to the wall behind the desk. Nothing happened. Heather moved the fingers of her left hand in a tiny circle on the resilient, grainy surface of the armchair, the stuff that had once been the skin of a living animal, the intermediate surface between a cow and the universe. The tune of the old record they had played yesterday came into her head and wouldn't get out again. What do you see when you turn out the light? I can't tell you, but I know it's mine. She wouldn't have thought that Haber could hold still, keep silent for so long. Only once his fingers flicked out to a dial, then he stood immobile again, watching the blank wall. George sighed, raised a hand sleepily, relaxed again, and woke. He blinked and sat up. His eyes went at once to Heather, as if to make sure she was there. Haber frowned, and with a jumpy, startled movement, pushed the lower button of the augmenter. "What the hell?" he said. He stared at the EEG screen, still jiggling with lively little traces. "The augmenter was feeding you D-state patterns. How the hell did you wake up?" "I don't know," George yawned. "I just did. Didn't you instruct me to wake soon?" "I generally do, on the signal. But how the hell did you override the pattern stimulation from the augmenter? I'll have to increase the power. Obviously been going at this too tentatively." He was now talking to the augmenter itself. There was no doubt of it. When that conversation was done, he turned abruptly on George and said, "All right, what was the dream?"
"Dreamed there was a picture of Mount Hood on the wall there behind my wife."
Haber's eyes flickered to the bare redwood paneled wall and back to George. "Anything else? An earlier dream? Any recall of it?"
"I think so. Wait a minute. I guess I dreamed that I was dreaming or something. I was confused. I was in a store. That's it. I was in Meyer and Frank's buying a new suit. It had to have a blue tunic because I was going to have a new job or something. I can't remember. But anyhow, they had a guide sheet that told you what you ought to weigh, if you're so tall and vice versa. And I was right in the middle of both the height scale and the weight scale for average-build men."
"Normal, in other words," Haber said, and suddenly laughed. He had a huge laugh. It startled Heather badly, after the tension and the silence. "That's fine, George. That's just fine." He clapped George on the shoulder and began taking the electrodes off his head. "We have made it. We have arrived. You're in the clear, do you know it?"
"I believe so," George replied mildly.
"The big load's off your shoulders, right?"
"And onto yours?"
"And on to mine, right." Again the big, gusty laugh, a little over-prolonged. Heather wondered if Haber was always like this, or was in the state of extreme excitement.
"Dr. Haber," her husband said, "have you ever talked to an alien about dreaming?"
"An Aldebaran, you mean? No. Ford in Washington tried out a couple of our tests on some of them, along with a whole series of psychological tests, but the results were meaningless. We simply haven't licked the communications problem there. They're intelligent, but Irchevsky, our best xenobiologist, thinks that they may not be rational at all, and that what looks like socially integrative behavior among humans is nothing but a kind of instinctual adaptive mimicry. No telling for sure. Can't get an EEG on them, and as a matter of fact, we can't even find out whether they sleep or not, let alone dream."
Do you know the term Iaklu?
Haber paused momentarily. Heard it. It's untranslatable. You've decided it means dream, eh?
George shook his head. I don't know what it means. I don't pretend to have any knowledge you haven't got. But I do think that before you go on with the application of the new technique, Dr. Haber, before you dream, you ought to talk with one of the aliens.
Which one?
The flick of irony was clear. Anyone, it doesn't matter.
Haber laughed. Talk about what, George?
Heather saw her husband's light eyes flash as he looked up at the bigger man. About me? About dreaming? About Iaklu? It doesn't matter. So long as you listen. They'll know what you're getting at. They're a lot more experienced than we are at all this.
At what?
At dreaming. At what dreaming is an aspect of. They've done it for a long time. For always, I guess. They are one of the dream time. I don't understand it. I can't say it in words. Everything dreams. The play of form, of being, is the dreaming of substance. Rocks have their dreams, and the earth changes. But when the mind becomes conscious, when the rate of evolution speeds up, then you have to be careful. Careful of the world. You must learn the way. You must learn the skills, the art, the limits. A conscious mind must be part of the whole, intentionally and carefully, as the rock is part of the whole unconsciously. Do you see? Does it mean anything to you?
It's not new to me, if that's what you mean. World, soul, and so on. Pre-scientific synthesis. Mysticism is one approach to the nature of dreaming, or of reality, though it's not acceptable to those willing to use reason and able to.
I don't know if that's true, George said, without the least resentment, though he was very earnest. But just out of scientific curiosity, then, at least try this. Before testing the augmenter on yourself, before you turn it on, when you're starting your auto-suggestion, say this, Er perehenne. Aloud, or in your mind, once, clearly, try it.
Why?
Because it works.
Works how?
You get a little help from your friends, George said. He stood up. Heather stared at him in terror. What he had been saying sounded crazy. Haber's cure had driven him insane. She had known it would. But Haber was not responding, was he? As he would to incoherent or psychotic talk. Iaklu is too much for one person to handle alone, George was saying. It gets out of hand. They know what's involved in controlling it, or not exactly controlling it, that's not the right word, but keeping it where it belongs, going the right way. I don't understand it. Maybe you will. Ask their help. Say Er perehenne before you press the on button.
You may have something there, Haber said. Might be worth investigating. I'll get on to it, George. I'll have one of the Albaranians from the Culture Center up and see if I can get some information on this. All Greek to you, eh, Mrs. Orr? This husband of yours should have gone into the shrink game, the research end of it. He's wasted as a draftsman.
Why did he say that? George was a parks and playgrounds designer.
He's got the flair. He's a natural. Never thought of hooking the Aldebarians in on this, but he might just have a real idea there. But maybe you're just as glad he's not a shrink, eh? Awful to have your spouse analyzing your unconscious desires across the dinner table, eh?
He boomed and thundered, showing them out. Heather was bewildered, nearly in tears. I hate him, she said fiercely, on the descending spiral of the escalator. He's a horrible man. False. A big fake. George took her arm. He said nothing. Are you through? Really through? You won't need drugs anymore, and you're all through these awful sessions? I think so. He'll file my papers, and in 6 weeks I should get a notice of clearance, if I behave myself. He smiled a little tiredly. This was tough on you, honey, but it wasn't on me. Not this time. I'm hungry, though. Where'll we go for dinner? The Casa Boliviana? Chinatown, she said, and then caught herself.
Ha ha, she added. The old Chinese district had been cleared away with the rest of the downtown at least 10 years ago. For some reason, she had completely forgotten that for a moment. I mean Ruby Liu's, she said, confused. George held her arm a little closer. Fine, he said. It was easy to get to. The funicular line stopped across the river in the old Lloyd Center, once the biggest shopping center in the world back before the crash. Nowadays, the vast multi-level parking lots were gone, along with the dinosaurs, and many of the shops and stores along the two-level mall were empty, boarded up. The ice rink had not been filled in 20 years. No water ran in the bizarre romantic fountains of twisted metal. Small ornamental trees had grown up towering. Their roots cracked the walkways for yards around their cylindrical planters. Voices and footsteps rang over clearly, a little hollowly before and behind one, walking those long, half-lit, half-derelict arcades. Ruby Liu's was on the upper level. The branches of a horse chestnut almost hid the glass facade. Overhead, the sky was an intense, delicate green, that color seen briefly on spring evenings when there is a clearing after rain. Heather looked up into that jade heaven, remote, improbable, serene. Her heart lifted. She felt anxiety begin to slip off her like a shed skin, but it did not last. There was a curious reversal, a shifting. Something seemed to catch at her, to hold her. She almost stopped walking and looked down from the sky of jade into the empty, heavy-shadowed walks before her. This was a strange place. It's spooky up here, she said. George shrugged, but his face looked tense and rather grim. A wind had come up, too warm for the Aprils of the old days, a wet, hot wind moving the great green-fingered branches of the chestnut, stirring litter far down the long, deserted turnings. The red neon sign behind the moving branches seemed to dim and waver with the wind, to change shape. It didn't say Ruby Liu's. It didn't say anything anymore. Nothing said anything. Nothing had meaning. The wind blew hollow in the hollow courts. Heather turned away from George and went off toward the nearest wall. She was in tears. In pain, her instinct was to hide, to get in a corner of a wall and hide. What is it, honey? It's all right. Hang on, it'll be all right. I am going insane, she thought. It wasn't George. It wasn't George all along. It was me. It'll be all right. But she heard in his voice that he did not believe it. She felt in his hands that he did not believe it. What's wrong? She cried, despairing. What's wrong? I don't know, he said, almost inattentively. He had lifted his head and turned a little from her, though he still held her to him to stop her crying fit. He seemed to be watching, to be listening. She felt the heart beat hard and steady in his chest. Heather, listen, I'm going to have to go back. Go back where? What is it that's wrong? Her voice was thin and high. To Haber. I have to go. Now. Wait for me, in the restaurant. Wait for me, Heather. Don't follow me. He was off. She had to follow. He went, not looking back, fast, down the long stairs, under the arcades, past the dry fountains, out to the funicular station. A car was waiting there at the end of the line. He hopped in. She scrambled on, her breath hurting in her chest, just as the car began to pull out. What the hell, George? I'm sorry. He was panting, too. I have to get there. I didn't want to take you into it. Into what? She detested him. They sat on facing seats, puffing at each other. What is this crazy performance? What are you going back there for? Haber is... George's voice went dry for a moment. He is dreaming, he said. A deep, mindless terror crawled inside Heather. She ignored it. Dreaming what? So what? Look out the window. She had looked only at him while they ran, and since they got onto the car. The funicular was crossing the river now, high above the water. But there was no water. The river had run dry. The bed of it lay cracked and oozing in the lights of the bridges, foul, full of grease and bones and lost tools and dying fish.
The great ships lay careened and ruined by the towering, slimy docks. The buildings of downtown Portland, the capital of the world, the high, new, handsome cubes of stone and glass, interspersed with measured doses of green, the fortresses of government, research and development, communications, industry, economic planning, environmental control, were melting. They were getting soggy and shaky, like jello left out in the sun. The corners had already run down the sides, leaving great creamy smears. The funicular was going very fast and not stopping at stations. Something must be wrong with the cable, Heather thought, without personal involvement. They swung rapidly over the dissolving city, low enough to hear the rumbling and the cries. As the car ran up higher, Mount Hood came into view behind George's head as he sat facing her. He saw the lurid light reflected on her face or in her eyes, perhaps, for he turned at once to look to see the vast inverted cone of fire. The car swung wild in the abyss, between the unforming city and the formless sky. "Nothing seems to go quite right today," said a woman farther back in the car in a loud, quivering voice. The light of the eruption was terrible and gorgeous. Its huge material geological vigor was reassuring compared to the hollow area that now lay ahead of the car at the upper end of the line. The presentiment which had seized Heather as she looked down from the jade sky was now a presence. It was there. It was an area, or perhaps a time period, of a sort of emptiness. It was the presence of absence, or unquantifiable entity without qualities, into which all things fell and from which nothing came forth. It was horrible, and it was nothing. It was the wrong way. Into this, as the funicular car stopped at its terminus, George went. He looked back at her as he went, crying out, "Wait for me, Heather! Don't follow me! Don't come!" But though she tried to obey him, it came to her. It was growing out from the center rapidly. She found that all things were gone, and that she was lost in the panic dark, crying out her husband's name with no voice, desolate until she sank down in a ball, curled about the center of her own being, and fell forever through the dry abyss. By the power of will, which is indeed great, when exercised in the right way at the right time, George Orr found beneath his feet the hard marble of the steps up to the Hurad Tower. He walked forward while his eyes informed him that he walked on mist, on mud, on decayed corpses, on innumerable tiny toads. It was very cold, yet there was a smell of hot metal and burning hair or flesh. He crossed the lobby. Gold letters from the aphorism around the dome leapt around him momentarily. Man, mankind, M-N-A-A-A. The A's tried to trip his feet. He stepped onto a moving walkway, though it was not visible to him. He stepped onto the helical escalator and rode it up into nothing, supporting it continually by the firmness of his will. He did not even shut his eyes. Up on the top story, the floor was ice. It was about a finger's width thick and quite clear. Through it could be seen the stars of the southern hemisphere. Orr stepped out onto it, and all the stars rang loud and false like cracked bells. The foul smell was much worse, making him gag. He went forward, holding out his hand. The panel of the door of Haber's outer office was there to meet it. He could not see it, but he touched it. A wolf howled. The lava moved toward the city. He went on and came to the last door. He pushed it open. On the other side of it, there was nothing. "Help me," he said aloud, for the void drew him, pulled at him. He had not the strength all by himself to get through nothingness and out the other side. There was a sort of dull rousing in his mind. He thought of Tiwak Enbe Enbe and of the bust of Schubert and of Heather's voice saying furiously, "What the hell, George?" This seemed to be all he had to cross nothingness on. He went forward. He knew as he went that he would lose all he had. He entered the eye of the nightmare. It was a cold, vaguely moving, rotating darkness made of fear that pulled him aside, pulled him apart. He knew where the augmenter stood. He put out his mortal hand along the way things go. He touched it,
felt for the lower button, and pushed it once. He crouched down then, covering his eyes and cowering, for the fear had taken his mind. When he raised his head and looked, the world re-existed. It was not in good condition, but it was there. They weren't in the Hurad Tower, but in some dingier, commoner office, which he had never seen before. Haber lay sprawled on the couch, massive, his beard jutting up, red-brown beard again, whitish skin, no longer gray. The eyes were half open and saw nothing. Orr pulled away the electrodes, whose wires ran like threadworms between Haber's skull and the augmenter. He looked at the machine, its cabinets all standing open. It should be destroyed, he thought, but he had no idea how to do it, nor any will to try. Destruction was not his line, and a machine is more blameless, more sinless even than any animal. It has no intentions whatsoever but our own. "Dr. Haber," he said, shaking the big, heavy shoulders a little. "Haber, wake up!" After a while, the big body moved and presently sat up. It was all slack and loose. The massive, handsome head hung between the shoulders. The mouth was loose. The eyes looked straight forward into the dark, into the void, into the unbeing at the center of William Haber. They were no longer opaque. They were empty. Orr became afraid of him physically and backed away from him. "I've got to get help," he thought. "I can't handle this alone." He left the office, went out through an unfamiliar waiting room, ran down the stairs. He had never been in this building and had no idea what it was or where. When he came out onto the street, he knew that it was a Portland street, but that was all. It was nowhere near Washington Park or the West Hills. It was no street he had ever walked on. The emptiness of Haber's being, the effect of nightmare, radiating outward from the dreaming brain, had undone connections. The continuity which had always held between the worlds, or timelines of Orr's dreaming, had now been broken. Chaos had entered in. He had few and incoherent memories of this existence he was now in, and almost all he knew came from the other memories, the other dream times. Other people less aware than he might be better equipped for this shift of existence, but they would be more frightened by it, having no explanation. They would be finding the world radically, senselessly, suddenly changed, with no possible rational cause of change. There would be much more death and terror following Dr. Haber's dream, and loss, and loss. He knew he had lost her, had known it since he stepped out, with her help, into the panic void surrounding the dreamer. She was lost, along with the world of the gray people and the huge, fake building into which he had run, leaving her alone in the ruin and dissolution of the nightmare. She was gone. He did not try to get help for Haber. There was no help for Haber, nor for himself. He had done all he ever would do. He walked on along the distracted streets. He saw from street signs that he was in the northeast part of Portland, an area he had never known much of. The houses were low, and at corners there was sometimes a view of the mountain. He saw that the eruption had ceased, had never in fact begun. Mount Hood rose dun violet into the darkening April sky, dormant. The mountain slept. Dreaming. Dreaming. Orr walked without goal, following one street and then another. He was exhausted, so that he sometimes wanted to lie down there on the pavement and rest for a while. Yet he kept going. He was approaching a business section now, coming closer to the river. The city, half wrecked and half transformed, a jumble and mess of grandiose plans and incomplete memories, swarmed like bedlam. Fires and insanities ran from house to house, and yet people went about their business as always. There were two men looting a jewelry shop, and past them came a woman who held her bawling red-faced baby in her arms and walked purposefully home, wherever home was. Chapter 11. The Last Chapter. Starlight asked Non-Entity, "Master, do you exist, or do you not exist?" He got no answer to his question, however. Chuang Tse, 22. Sometime that night, as Orr was trying to find his way through the suburbs of Chaos to Corbett Avenue, an Aldebaran alien stopped him and persuaded him to come with it. He came along, docile. He asked it, after a while, if it was Tiwak Enbe Enbe, but he did not ask with much conviction, and did not seem to mind when the alien explained, rather laboriously, that he was called Georgior and it was called Anamamin Asfa. It took him to its apartment near the river, over a bicycle repair shop and next door to the Hope Eternal Gospel Mission, which was pretty full up tonight. All over the world, the various gods were being requested, more or less politely, for an explanation of what had occurred between 6:25 and 7:08 p.m., Pacific Standard Time. Sweetly discordant, Rock of Ages rang underfoot as they climbed dark stairs to a second-story flat. The alien there suggested that he lie down on the bed, as he looked tired. "Sleep that knits up the raveled sleeve of care," it said. "To sleep, perchance to dream. Aye, there's the rub," Orr replied. There was, he thought, something to the curious manner in which the aliens communicated, but he was much too tired to decide what. "Where will you sleep?" he inquired, sitting down heavily on the bed. "Nowhere," the alien replied, its toneless voice dividing the word into two equally significant holes. Orr stooped to unlace his shoes. He didn't want to get the alien's bedspread dirty with his shoes. That would be scarcely a fair return for kindness. Stooping made him dizzy. "I'm tired," he said. "I did a lot today. That is, I did something. The only thing I have ever done. I pressed a button. It took the entire willpower, the accumulated strength of my entire existence, to press one damned off button." "You have lived well," the alien said. It was standing in a corner, apparently intending to stand there indefinitely. It was not standing there, Orr thought, not in the same way that he would stand or sit or lie or be. It was standing there in the way that he, in a dream, might be standing. It was there in the sense that in a dream one is somewhere. He lay back. He clearly sensed the pity and protective compassion of the alien, standing across the dark room. It saw him, not with eyes, as short-lived, fleshy, armorless, a strange creature, infinitely vulnerable, adrift in the gulfs of the possible, something that needed help. He didn't mind. He did need help. Weariness took him over, picked him up like a current of the sea, into which he was sinking slowly. "Er perihene," he muttered, surrendering to sleep. "Er perihene," replied Anemamin Asfa soundlessly. Orr slept. He dreamed. There was no rub. His dreams, like waves of the deep sea far from any shore, came and went, rose and fell, profound and harmless, breaking nowhere, changing nothing. They danced the dance among all the other waves in the sea of being. Through his sleep, the great green sea turtles dived, swimming with heavy, inexhaustible grace through the depths in their element. In early June, the trees were in full leaf and the roses blooming. All over the city, the large, old-fashioned ones, tough as weeds, called the Portland Rose, flowered pink on thorny stems. Things had settled down pretty well. The economy was recovering. People were mowing their lawns. Orr was at the Federal Asylum for the Insane at Linton, a little north of Portland. The buildings, put up early in the 90s, stood on a great bluff overlooking the water meadows of the Willamette and the Gothic elegance of the St. John's Bridge. They had been horribly overcrowded there in late April and May with the plague of mental breakdowns that had followed on the inexplicable events of the evening that was now referred to as the break. But that had eased off, and asylum routine was back to its understaffed, overcrowded, terrible norm. A tall, soft-spoken orderly took Orr upstairs to the single-bed rooms in the north wing. The door leading into this wing and the doors of all the rooms in it were heavy, with a little spy hole grating 5 feet up, and all of them were locked. "It's not that he's troublesome," the orderly said as he unlocked the corridor door. "Never been violent, but he had this bad effect on the others.
We tried him in two wards. No go. The others were scared of him. Never saw anything like it. They all affect each other and get panics and wild nights and so on, but not like this. They were scared of him. Be clawing at the doors nights to get away from him. And all he ever did was just lay there. Well, you see everything here, sooner or later. He don't care where he is, I guess. Here you are. He unlocked the door and preceded Orr into the room. Visitor, Dr. Haber, he said. Haber was thin. The blue and white pajamas hung lank on him. His hair and beard were cut shorter, but were well cared for and neat. He sat on the bed and stared at the void. Dr. Haber, Orr said, but his voice failed. He felt excruciating pity and fear. He knew what Haber was looking at. He had seen it himself. He was looking at the world after April 1998. He was looking at the world as misunderstood by the mind, the bad dream. There is a bird in a poem by T.S. Eliot who says that mankind cannot bear very much reality, but the bird is mistaken. A man can endure the entire weight of the universe for 80 years. It is unreality that he cannot bear. Haber was lost. He had lost touch. Orr tried to speak again, but found no words. He backed out, and the orderly, right with him, closed and locked the door. I can't, Orr said. There's no way. No way, the orderly said. Going down the corridor, he added in his soft voice, Dr. Walters tells me he was a pretty promising scientist. Orr returned to downtown Portland by boat. Transportation was still rather confused. Pieces, remnants, and commencements of about 6 different public transportation systems cluttered up the city. Reed College had a subway station, but no subway. The funicular to Washington Park ended at the entrance to a tunnel which went halfway under the Willamette and then stopped. Meanwhile, an enterprising fellow had refitted a couple of boats that used to run tours up and down the Willamette and Columbia, and was using them as ferries on regular runs between Linton, Vancouver, Portland, and Oregon City. It made a pleasant trip. Orr had taken a long lunch hour for the visit to the asylum. His employer, the alien Anemamon Asfa, was indifferent to hours worked and interested only in work done. When one did it, it was one's own concern. Orr did a good deal of his in his head, lying in bed half awake for an hour before he got up in the morning. It was 3 o'clock when he got back to the kitchen sink and sat down in front of his drafting table in the workshop. Asfa was in the showroom, waiting on customers. He had a staff of 3 designers and contracts with various manufacturers who made kitchen equipment of all sorts, bowls, cookware, implements, tools, everything short of heavy appliances. Industry and distribution had been left in disastrous confusion by the break. National and international government had been so distraught for weeks that a state of laissez-faire had prevailed perforce, and small private firms that had been able to keep going or get started during this period were in a good position. In Oregon, a number of those firms, all handling material goods of one kind or another, were run by Aldebarians. They were good managers and extraordinary salesmen, though they had to hire human beings for all handwork. The government liked them because they willingly accepted governmental constraints and controls, for the world economy was gradually pulling itself back together. People were even talking about the gross national product again, and President Myrtle had predicted a return to normalcy by Christmas. Asfa sold retail as well as wholesale, and the kitchen sink was popular for its sturdy wares and fair prices. Since the break, housewives, refurnishing the unexpected kitchens they had found themselves cooking in that evening in April, had come in increasing numbers. Orr was looking over some wood samples for cutting boards when he heard one saying, I'd like one of those egg whisks. And because the voice reminded him of his wife's voice, he got up and looked into the showroom. Asfa was showing something to a middle-sized brown woman of 30 or so, with short, black, wiry hair on a well-shaped head. Heather, he said, coming forward. She turned. She looked at him for what seemed a long time. Orr, she said. George Orr, right? When did I know you? He hesitated. Aren't you a lawyer?
Anemamon Aspa stood immense in greenish armor, holding an egg whisk.
Nope, legal secretary. I work for Rudy and Goodhue in the Pendleton building.
That must be it. I was in there once. Do you like that? I designed it.
He took another egg whisk from the bin and displayed it to her.
Good balance, see? And it works fast. They usually make the wires too taut or too heavy, except in France.
It's good looking, she said. I have an old electric mixer, but I wanted at least to hang that on the wall.
You work here? You didn't used to.
I remember now. You were in some office on Stark Street, and you were seeing a doctor on voluntary therapy.
He had no idea what or how much she recalled, nor how it would fit in with his own multiple memories. His wife, of course, had been gray-skinned. There were still gray people now, it was said, particularly in the Middle West and Germany, but most of the rest had gone back to white, brown, black, red, yellow, and mixtures. His wife had been a gray person, a far gentler person than this one, he thought. This Heather carried a big black handbag with a brass snap, and probably a half pint of brandy inside. She came on hard. His wife had been unaggressive and, though courageous, timid in manner. This was not his wife, but a fiercer woman, vivid and difficult.
That's right, he said. Before the break, we had... Actually, Miss Leelock, we had a date for lunch at Dave's on Ankeny. We never made it.
I'm not Miss Leelock. That's my maiden name. I'm Mrs. Andrews.
She eyed him with curiosity. He stood and endured reality.
My husband was killed in the war in the Near East, she added.
Yes, Orr said.
Do you design all these things?
Most of the tools and stuff, and the cookware.
Look, do you like this?
He hauled out a copper-bottom tea kettle, massive and yet elegant, as proportioned by necessity as a sailing ship.
Who wouldn't? She said, putting out her hands.
He gave it to her. She hefted and admired it.
I like things, she said.
He nodded.
You're a real artist. It's beautiful.
Mr. Orr is expert with tangibles, the proprietor put in, toneless, speaking from the left elbow.
Listen, I remember, Heather said suddenly. Of course, it was before the break. That's why it all mixed up in my mind. You thought you dreamed things that came true, didn't you? And the doctor was making you do more and more of it, and you didn't want him to, and you were looking for a way to get out of voluntary therapy with him without getting clobbered with obligatory.
See, I do remember it. Did you ever get assigned to another shrink?
No, outgrew him, Orr said, and laughed.
She also laughed.
What did you do about the dreams?
Oh, went on dreaming.
I thought you could change the world. Is this the best you could do for us, this mess?
It'll have to do, he said. He would have preferred less of a mess himself, but it wasn't up to him, and at least it had her in it. He had sought her as best he could, had not found her, and had turned to his work for solace. It had not given much, but it was the work he was fit to do, and he was a patient man. But now his dry and silent grieving for his lost wife must end. For there she stood, the fierce, recalcitrant, and fragile stranger, forever to be won again. He knew her. He knew his stranger, how to keep her talking and how to make her laugh. He said finally, "Would you like a cup of coffee? There's a cafe next door. It's time for my break."
"The hell it is," she said. It was 4:45. She glanced over at the alien.
"Sure I'd like some coffee, but..."
"I'll be back in 10 minutes. Anemamon Aspa,"
Orr said to his employer as he went for his raincoat.
"Take evening," the alien said. "There is time. There are returns. To go is to return."
"Thank you very much," Orr said, and shook hands with his boss.
The big green flipper was cool on his human hand. He went out with Heather into the warm, rainy afternoon of summer. The alien watched them from within the glass-fronted shop, as a sea creature might watch from an aquarium, seeing them pass and disappear into the mist.
This concludes the reading of The Lathe of Heaven by Ursula K. Le Guin. This book was read by Susan O'Malley. Thank you.